Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson on Interpreter Foundation Radio with my co-host John Gee and Kevin Christensen. Good evening, Kevin and John.
Good evening.
Kevin. Good evening.
And I want to welcome you to our broadcast this evening. And as we begin, we want to mention that we have a new sponsor here on the program. It is, let me just get my note here.
LDS Realtors?
LDS, well, LDS Agent, I think is what it's called.
Okay.
LDSAgents.com is our new sponsor for our broadcast this evening and every other Sunday night. And LDSAgents.com is a network of over 3,000 friendly, top-quality Latter-day Saint real estate agents. Now, for over 20 years, LDSAgents.com has been serving home buyers and sellers throughout the United States and Canada. I've been doing a lot in the real estate market the last few years, and I can tell you it is hot everywhere, at least here in the United States. And in particular, if you're buying or selling a home and you want to reduce the stress of your move, get in touch with LDSAgents.com. The agents are experienced professionals who will focus on what matters most to you. They'll find a home in a safe neighborhood with good schools and nearby wards or branches. And if you need information about youth sporting programs or schools for special needs kids, they can help as well. So you can work with a real estate agent who shares your values and one that you can trust. So go to LDSAgents.com on the internet, and for over 20 years, they've been serving thousands of clients just like you. So wherever you are, no matter where you're moving, give LDSAgents.com a try. Just go to their easy-to-use website. It's packed with useful information. And once again, that is LDSAgents.com. So I want to thank them as a sponsor for this broadcast. There is a lot going on, John and Kevin, particularly with regard to Interpreter Foundation. Since we were here on this program, the Witnesses movie was premiered at the LDS Film Festival about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I had the opportunity to see it. Now, I know John's seen a rough cut already, and Kevin, I don't know if you haven't. You haven't?
I have not.
I haven't seen it.
I tell you, it was very good. I had a certain expectation going in, and it surpassed it. Now, it is a certain type of a movie, so, you know, they don't blow up a lot of things. They don't do a lot of, you know, it's not high drama.
And probably not a lot of CGI.
Well, they still had some effects to tune up a bit.
Right, apparently. But no. It's not heavy CGI.
No.
It's not all filmed in front of a green screen.
No. And I'll tell you what, though. The filming is spectacular. The settings are beautiful and gorgeous. It definitely was not filmed in Utah.
And, well, and many of the settings, not all of them, but many of them were as close as they could get on site.
Uh-huh. And, I'm really excited. It's going to be released June 4th, I believe, in theaters, and hopefully most theaters will be open by then. We still don't, you know back and forth, but it seems that things are progressing real well in that area. A little later in the fall, they're going to put out the documentary that's attached to the movie, which will have interviews with scholars like Richard Anderson and others about the witnesses themselves and kind of the background. And knowing the story as I did, it still was amazing to me that they caught the essence of it. We're embargoed for a full review, so I'm just talking about my personal experience at the moment. I'm sure Dan's probably sitting here going, okay, Terry, enough of that. Let's put it back in the box. But I will just tell you that it will be something in a few months that you'll want to take your families to.
I've heard everybody who was able to go said that it is worth seeing.
Yeah, and afterwards they had some of the people involved in making the movie get up and answer questions, and there were pretty interesting questions. And one of the things that came out was that the actors who played David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery are not LDS. And, there were some interesting stories about that about things that they learned in conversations they had with various people on the film. during the production that was pretty interesting. But I would say that those who are promoting this film on behalf of Interpreter, that they know what they're talking about. This will be something that'll be pretty enjoyable for families to go to. So that's one of the things that's going on. There's some other things. I guess about a week ago, BYU had a conference on the Hebrews. It's out on Kindle, by the way, in electronic version. I haven't seen the hard copies yet.
That was the that's the BYU New Testament commentary.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Not part of Interpreter per se, but still. Yes, the volume is, it is out at least in Kindle. It should be out in the next few weeks.
Yeah, they said the next
few
weeks.
In hard copy.
You'll be able to pick one up either online or you can go to Deseret Book.
And if you're feeling bad that you missed the conference, all the presentations are up on YouTube.
Okay.
So you can watch them. It's not... It was a virtual conference, and so most of the presentations are shorter than a
there
typical
is something to be said for that, guys.
A typical academic conference where you will get on usually academic conference, you expect a 20-minute paper. If it's one of the keynotes, then it could be hour and a half. These presentations were significantly shorter, at least mine was.
There's always something to be said for that. And I would mention that both Kevin and John did a presentation on Hebrews, was it 2 years ago at
something
BYU?
Like that.
In fact, 2019, yeah, fall of 2019.
Yeah, in fact, that's the first time I met Kevin in person.
Yeah,
me too. You know, so it was great. And I think, did you forget something there at that? I can't remember.
Yeah, I forgot to have an opening prayer.
Oh, there you go. He's been at BYU too long.
Yeah,
time to go, John.
either that or I haven't been there long enough.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, there's...
Well, there was one more thing. Yesterday,
yes.
There was the formal presentation of the FET shrift for Papers in Honor of Lewis Midgley, Remembrance and Return. They had that on his 90th birthday.
Oh, they finally did that.
Yes.
They finally did that.
So we'll be able to get copies of that. I know Kevin's had his for a while.
Yeah, I somehow got one.
Somehow you managed to get one where those of us who did something for it.
Well, he did too. Kevin did something in there.
Well, some of us haven't.
Haven't seen it yet.
Haven't seen it yet. But maybe we can now.
Yeah, hopefully.
There's some interesting things in that volume, and including a contribution by the late Bill Hamblin.
Mm-hmm.
For a while there, Bill and one of his friends were doing parodies of various songs or poems, and this one is a parody of Rudyard Kipling's Gunga Din called Lou the Mean.
Well, I never had a class from him. I have read his stuff over the years, both from Farms and Interpreter. And I do remember, though, that one of the guys I went to law school with, who's now a federal judge in Arizona, by the way, was very impressed with him and that Lou had a big impact on him as a teacher and mentor.
Lou is an amazing individual and has had left a big impression on people as a teacher. I never have formally had a class from him, but he certainly gave me an education 1 year.
Well,
helped me get through graduate school.
You know, speaking of that, he has an article, as does John, by the way, in a new book that Interpreter has coming out in the next couple of months. And we're going to talk a little bit about it today.
Oh, yes.
It's
called Nibley Observed, and it's reminiscences about Hugh Nibley. And this is an impressive, or Hugh Nibley Observed, that's the title.
It's called Hugh Nibley Observed. It's edited by Jeff Bradshaw, Shirley Ricks, and Stephen Whitlock, with a foreword, of course, by Jack Welch. And it's co-published by Interpreter Foundation, but they've got permission to put the Farms logo on it, the old Farms logo, which I kind of like that on the cover.
Yeah. There's a story there, but I'm not really at liberty to tell what little I know of it. So
we'll just say we got permission.
I know they have permission. It is, so this contains a number of tributes by his children. A number of the talks that they gave at his funeral. And it also contains the proceedings of a symposium that they held a couple of years later, sort of
the
memorial.
The Nibley Centennial Lecture Series.
Yeah. So I guess
from 2010. From 2010.
And then there are a few other ones. So my contribution is one that was commissioned just a few months back.
A few months ago, 6 months. That's pretty quick for you to get it into press.
It's not the fastest thing I've gotten in press, but I was really amazed how fast they were able to work on that.
Yeah, so just a note for future programming. Next month, John and Kevin and I will have the opportunity to have at least one of the Nibley children on the air with us, with Jeff Bradshaw. That's the tentative plan. We'll keep working on that premise, and we'll be talking about this book for the hour that we have, the first hour, and that'll be on April the 11th. So in the meantime, though, I've been going through this, and I am excited about it. I really enjoyed Boyd Peterson's biography of Hugh called A Consecrated Life. And I talked about it on my program in St. George. I interviewed Boyd on one of the programs for an hour. It was just a real great experience, and it covered the subject very well. Alternated the chapters between the chronology of what was happening in his life and then a topical essay. So, for example, they would spend a chapter talking about his focus on the Book of Mormon or on the Pearl of Great Price and on consecration and on temples. And just a fascinating look, a very honest biography, particularly as far as authorized biographies go by family members. I mean, they didn't turn him into a saint, let's say, but they were very honest, and it was just really enjoyable. In fact, I found myself going back and rereading it again a few months ago, not knowing that this new book would be coming out as a kind of a companion to it.
Yeah, and then one of his sons also did a
Sergeant Nibley,
PhD,
yeah.
Which as a look inside World War II, it was put together some of the correspondence. It was fascinating what they were able to do in reconstructing it. And I'd heard some of those stories told by Nibley himself, but I hadn't had the context that Alex is able to put those in. And it's to come through and survive that war was just amazing. One of the Nibley's army buddies from military intelligence said, "Why is it everything happens to Nibley, but nothing happens to Nibley?" He really had a ringside seat into lots of those.
Well, he was running around on Omaha Beach or one of the beaches there.
Utah Beach. Yeah, he was the first to land, actually.
And
driving up through the water in his Jeep.
Uh-huh.
He was the very first.
Well, and we've talked on this program before about some of our experiences with Nibley, but John's article in particular goes into much more depth about your relationship with him. At least, not in great detail, but a lot more than what we've you know, the I think people make an assumption that you and he were just kindred spirits.
Similar interests, but he really was my grandpa's age.
Yeah. And your dad had a class from him.
My dad had a class from him. Mm-hmm. And, it's... and Nibley didn't have many friends, and I wouldn't count myself as one of them. But there was a sort of student-professor relationship.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I suppose I got about as close as anybody in my generation did, which isn't terribly close.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the stories to prove it.
Yeah, but you had four classes from him, I guess, and I only had the one. How about you, Kevin?
Well, the one time I could have met him was at the Sunstone Roast that his family arranged, and I was sitting at the table right next to the Nibley family, and I would have been, my chair was right next to where he would have been sitting, but he got dehydrated and wasn't able to attend. So that was as close as I came. I did meet Tom at the Barker Seminar and talked to him also at the NDE conference, and had some correspondence with Zina over an article we had in the Interpreter, but that's as close as I got.
Well, you know, there's an appreciation by Stephen Whitlock, one of the editors of this volume, and he said I think he only met him one time, and that was in his office. He never had a class from him, never had a lot of contact with him other than through his writings, and I would have to say I had the class, and I did have one contact with him at his office where I had a specific question. But other than that, it's the same, just through the...
Well, he had an amazing impact on a whole generation of scholars who did take classes from him, and indirectly through a great... through his writings with a large number of other people that were influenced for the good... through his writings, and who never met him. And I think one of the surprises, I don't think I'm giving anything away here, but one of the things that surprised him the last couple of years when he was bedridden were the number of people who he never met who would come and tell him what an impact it had on their lives.
Mm-hmm. The Fest trip that they did in the early 90s has some contributors on there that just, his acquaintanceship was extremely broad. I mean, you had Aziz Atiyah,
Jacob Milgram, if I remember right, James Charlesworth.
Yes, Charlesworth was in it, yes.
And, you know, those are some fairly big names.
Yeah.
Cyrus Gordon was in there, wasn't he?
Who?
Cyrus Gordon. I think so.
Neusner was in there.
Yeah, Neusner.
Neusner was in there. Mm-hmm. I don't think Gordon was.
No, maybe not, yeah.
But,
there was somebody else. There were a couple of others, too. Just
and
phenomenal.
Then, of course, lots of Nibley students.
Yes.
That was done back at a time when I was not at the stage where I would have been thought of.
Well, the thing is, at that time, I don't recall that anybody was doing Fest trips for BYU professors.
Not for Latter-day Saints at all.
He was one of the first ones, if not the first. And then later, we have the two volumes for Richard Anderson, and now it becomes a lot more common.
A little more common. It's also dying out a bit, too, because not everyone probably deserves a Festschrift.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a huge deal, and a lot of publishers refuse to publish Festschrifts now.
They don't
sell well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Kevin, I know that they did something at SBL, John. They did something, and then Margaret Barker spoke specifically about a Nibley topic at SBL.
Yeah.
Tell
she
us
did
a
review
about
of
that, Kevin.
Well, I wasn't directly involved. I just read about it, and I've read the paper. But they at SBL, when they were doing a thing about Nibley, and she spoke about his article on the Christian envy of the temple and her response to it. And it's very favorable, and she appreciated his she saw him as holding up very well, and having insights that were far beyond what anybody else was doing at the time. And she didn't talk about it so much in the personal paper about it, but she told when she came to BYU for the first time in 2003, they would dole Margaret out for little smaller meetings with groups of scholars over meals. You'd get her for breakfast or lunch or dinner, just so that there could be a small, more intimate discussion. And she told John Tvednis that one of the things that turned her toward the temple was in 1965, she found an article in Jewish Quarterly Review called Christian Envy of the Temple. And that was one of the things that, she said nobody else is writing about. And that was one of the things that turned her in that direction, the temple studies that she's made her life work. So we can't know what influence we're going to have for good or evil. But this idea that the sense of connection sometimes is pretty amazing, that we can put something out there and we have, no idea who it's going to influence. So we should take some thought about what kind of bread we're casting on the waters. This is what Alma talks about, that the things that you do good, they go out, they'll return good to you, and the other things the same. So it's looking at Nibley's impact over several generations now. It's astonishing, just like when we go back and when we're talking about Sunday school, when we look at Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery, back in just the first years of the church, and think about the influence that these people have had back then and how it's multiplied over the generations. It becomes pretty amazing. And so to take seriously what we do with our lives, because it does make a difference.
One other quick anecdote about the influence of Nibley. I remember one of my graduate school professors, Moshe Weinfeld, was...
Yeah, he did the Anchor
Bible Commentary on Deuteronomy.
On Deuteronomy, and then he passed away. And I think
David Seeley
is supposed to finish. Yeah. Okay.
But he was one of his big discoveries. He was a little bit taken aback that Nibley had beat him into print on it. That Nibley had discovered the same thing. And he already had it in print before.
Well, he was a fast writer.
Well,
there was more to it than that.
Yeah, there was more. But he says, I've discovered this thing and no one else has discovered it. And I said, well, actually, Hugh Nibley already published on this.
Uh huh.
So, he was able to keep up with anybody.
So I would just say, be looking for this book, Hugh Nibley Observed, from Interpreter in a couple of months. By the way, there are 240 illustrations or photographs in this to go along with the articles. I mean, it's just looks like a tremendous package. And for those people who don't know who Hugh Nibley was, I mean, Kevin, I'm afraid some of us are getting close to dinosaur age here. I mean, we're not 90 like Lou Midgley, but we're getting up there. So, we know Nibley. We had classes from him. We studied him growing up. But there's a lot of young people in the church today who
never
don't really. And so I think it would be good for us to be able to somehow reach out and communicate that, because his work still holds up pretty well, as Margaret says.
It does.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I would be pleased if my work held up 50 years from now the way that his has. And I discuss some of that. And people who want to dive into Nibley, I'll recommend one of two books to start with, because some of his material is fairly daunting, but if you want to just dip your toe in, try either the world and the prophets or approaching Zion.
Approaching Zion.
One of those two is probably the easiest way to get into what Nibley talked about. Yeah, if you're reading Approaching Zion, be prepared to be moved to repentance.
Yeah, there's also the little quote book that Gary Gillum did, of all things, you know, if a person doesn't think of themselves as a scholar and just wants to get the flavor of it, there's a lot there. But, you know, for me, it was just, you know, he was asked to write the priesthood manual for the church in 1957. And, of course, the Book of Mormon, yeah.
I found
and
one.
That was, yeah. That was my introduction. I was on my mission. The member just loaned me the book because in the conversations, he thought that I was the kind of person who'd be interested in that particular book. So I read it, and it was life-changing for me because when I came back, I just had to track down all things Nibley. So, and
was it orange? This was
I think it was blue.
Blue? Because I found an orange-covered one.
An orange-covered one
that was in a closet in one of my missionary apartments. Someone had left it there. And I'll tell you, yeah, that was an eye-opener.
Well, so moving from, I guess, the esteem to the reverse
yes.
of that.
So, you know, I got a call from my mission companion, Malcolm Adcock. He is the public affairs director for the church in Great Britain and also in Western Europe. And he was telling me that this... Murder Among the Mormons documentary from Netflix has been getting a lot of press attention across the water, as they say. And it's done some here. My wife and I actually watched it, all 3 hours of it the other night. And it brought back a lot of memories. I was just finishing up law school when all that was going on. And then the guilty pleas and everything else, which took about a year and a half to get that all resolved from when the bombings occurred. The bombings occurred in October of 85. And I remember the discoveries of the documents and the controversies on the Joseph Smith blessing when, you know, the salamander letter and everything else. And then I went in the military as a prosecutor, by the way. So I had a little bit of an interest from that standpoint. And then when I was gone, I was not here on the Wasatch Front when they released the confessions, so to speak, those interviews, I know. And so I was, you know, this brought back a lot of memories for me. And I remember reading all four of the books. There were four books that came out at that time on the subject. And I figured if I got all four, I probably would have a better picture because each one kind of had their own viewpoint.
Good way
and
to
some
put
of
it.
Them were let's say some of them were not worth as much as others, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. I did like Salamander and Victims. And I got through Lindsay's book. I thought it was fine. It was, you know, workmanlike. But the fourth one, the Mormon Murders.
Yeah.
That was the one that I still remember that one vividly for one passage in it where they, in all seriousness, say that you can't trust Mormons because their health code makes them look younger than they really are, as though this is some culturally wide, you know, conspiracy to deceive people about how, you know, our natural aging process. It's a strange book. It's not worth reading unless you're in the mood for laughing at how bad it is.
Unfortunately, I was in the military, and one of the guys in our ward had read that book, and he was a fairly new convert. He'd only been a member for about a year and a half, and it really affected him for a while, and it took a while to get him back on track, which thankfully we were able to do, and that one more than any of the others. And that's when I said, well, you know, there are three others, and some of them are, you know, much more helpful on this subject. I was glad to see that they interviewed Richard Turley as one of the main subjects in the documentary.
Yeah.
I thought that was really helpful.
I think his book, Victims, is actually the best of them.
Yeah, it is the best.
Although there are some really useful things in Salamander and not necessarily what that are useful in ways that probably the authors didn't intend. But we remember going through all of that, and it changed a couple of things. One of the things that it made me more aware of at the time is provenance. And so, for example, I occasionally get people who come in and bring in artifacts to be authenticated. And the Hoffman episode affected me two ways on that. One of them is that, as George Throckmorton points out, and he was the one who discovered forgeries, mm-hmm. is you can't authenticate anything. You can show that it's fake, or you can show that
it might
your
be.
Tests don't show that it's fake.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't show that it's true. And I try to explain that to people who bring things to authenticate. And the other thing is the importance of provenance.
Do you get their money before you start explaining that, John?
I've never been paid for any of this.
Well, they get what they pay for, right?
Well, and actually, in some cases, I say, well, let's see. If a lawyer gets paid $250 an hour, and he's had 3 years of graduate school, I've had a decade, so I ought to charge three times that much. What do you think? Nobody wants to do that. But the other thing is, the first thing I ask about is the provenance.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this thing come from?
Well, we talked about that.
Right.
With the secret the gospel of Jesus' wife.
Yeah.
With Karen King from Harvard just several months ago, I think.
Right.
In the summer.
Provenance is a big thing. And you can, and sometimes you can tell a lot from the provenance. Sometimes it's not as informative as you'd like, but you really have to be aware of something that doesn't have a provenance. Because that's one of the main ways that forgeries get out in circulation, is they don't have a provenance. Now, there are authentic things that don't have provenance either.
Well, you know,
it's one of those things that if it doesn't, then mm-hmm. you want to be extra careful.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of people and maybe some of our listeners who don't know as much about this story. So let me just tell you that beginning in 1980, Mark Hoffman discovered what he purported to be the Anthon transcript, is what everybody calls it. And it was in a Bible that was alleged to have been owned by Joseph Smith's family. And apparently, and this is portrayed in the documentary, he glued the pages together, but when he did, he slipped this document he had created that had some characters which he claimed were from the Golden Plates, and those were the documents that Martin Harris had taken to Professor Charles Anthon on his trip to the East Coast to try and authenticate or verify. And so that's why it's called the Anthon transcript. And that's the first time, really, that Hoffman came to public attention. Before then, he'd just been a student. Then he donated to the church, or he sold it to the church or something. And that there were pictures of the first presidency with President Kimball and President Romney, President Tanner, and I think President Hinckley may have been in the presidency by then, and if not,
before then.
But I think he might have been in the photograph too. I'm not sure. I can't remember.
He was, of all the members of the Quorum of the Twelve,
he was more involved in.
He was
yes.
the most active in doing history of the Latter-day Saints.
And then, I guess about a year later, Hoffman again came on the scene, having discovered a blessing that was from Joseph Smith, where he blessed his son, Joseph III, that he would succeed him as president of the church. And that caused a stir. And I remember that was in the summer of 81, just as I was coming home from my mission.
It was about this time of year in 1981.
Then it was right before, because I remember, I think, reading about it in the grocery store in a Time magazine. we were waiting to check out. I think I saw it there. And then, of course, you know, down the road, we go jump down 3 or 4 years, and he finds some other things. And apparently, according to the documentary, he forged other documents and then had other dealers who he gave them to or sold them to or traded them to for legitimate documents or money. And then they donated to the church, so they got some of the credit too. But as it turns out, nearly all of those documents led back to Hoffman once they traced it all fully.
Yeah.
And it was a weird time, because I remember there's the big thing, and John, you've mentioned this in something that you wrote for yourself at that time. Well, it wasn't just for yourself, but... Yeah. As it turns out, it was for yourself. But the Oliver Cowdery history, and I distinctly remember all the rumors about that and hearing about this secret history of Oliver Cowdery that was going to undermine the church. And the L.A. Times put it out that there was there. And nobody could tell them no, even after Hoffman went to prison and said it was there's never anything there. They continued to try and harp on that.
It did. Well, this was actually, Hoffman not only created forged documents, he created rumors of documents.
Yes.
And so he claimed that this Oliver Cowdery history is in the First Presidency vault. And according to the transcripts of his interviews, he created it over a hamburger that he told to his best friend, who got excited about those sorts of things, and the best friend spread it all through the
around. That was Brent, wasn't it?
That was Brent Metcalf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he and at the time, and this is one of the things that's brought out by victims, at the time the church actually didn't have a complete catalog of all the holdings in the archives. And also, there isn't really a First Presidency vault.
Yeah.
And so that had some people who knew about that scratching their head saying, there is no vault. And but they didn't know everything that they had. And so one of the consequences of this is that the church archives spent, I want to say 3 years, but it may have been more or less than that. It was a number of years cataloging everything so that they knew everything that they had. And while they were at it, and this is in the back, in appendix and victims, they listed out all of the documents that passed through Hoffman's hands. So one of the things that Hoffman would do is go gather old, authentic documents at yard sales or whatever, however he was doing it, and then add a forged signature to it, and then turn around and sell it on the document market because it had the signature of this famous Latter-day Saint in the past. And to this day, nobody knows all of the Hoffman forgeries that...
The church knows which ones they have.
And we know which ones are connected to LDS church history. But he also started forging.
Oh, he did a lot. Americana, the Oath of a Freeman, which is focused on in the documentary, and a lot of other things.
Right.
Emily Dickinson poems.
Yes.
There's a book written about that too.
So he forged all this other stuff, and no one knows the extent to which forgeries.
One of the things that came out is that he would talk to people about what they were looking for, and then somehow he would create it and then go, quote, find it. End quote. And that happened, like, with the Salamander letter. It happened definitely with the Joseph Smith blessing.
Yeah, with the Joseph Smith third blessing.
Go ahead.
And the Dunham letter.
Yeah.
Was another one of those.
So the Joseph Smith the third blessing, he talked extensively with Michael Quinn about this sort of thing. And then forged the document tailor-made to what he had learned from Quinn.
Well, and then the historians would then authenticate it based on what they understood the history to be. And because it was fairly close to, or reasonably close to, what they were looking for and expecting, it was a lot easier. I guess Dean Jesse fell into the same, concern.
They pretty much across the board.
Yeah.
All the church historians, historians of the church did that. The one that I think disappointed Hoffman is that he forged the Salamander letter to match Gerald Tanner's
Gerald never bought
and
it.
Never bought it and thought it was a forgery.
Uh-huh.
Sandra thought it was genuine, but
Sandra was on the documentary. And interestingly enough, she was labeled as a critic to the church, whereas not everybody on there, for example, Brent, who's been critical of the church, wasn't listed that way. But he was treated in the documentary more as a victim, and frankly, I did feel quite a bit of empathy for him. He felt bad that he had been duped, and it really shook him, and that came out in the documentary. It was a very emotional type of thing for him and their portrayal of him.
Yeah, I won't speak to that,
mm-hmm.
but. One of the things that's really interesting, if you go back through what was happening, some of the document or the public things that were done at the time, is you look at President Hinckley and then President Oakes roles in this thing. So at the President Hinckley was in the first presidency for most of this, not at the very beginning. He was in the Quorum of the 12. But he actually would address these things in general conference and other things. And if you look at what he says, he'd always say something like, this document, if genuine, shows this. And that was always the way he couched it. But most of the historians and some of the church public affairs people didn't follow his lead on that. And they never had the if genuine. And there's also some of then Elder Oakes's talks, and he was, towards the end, he was a new member of the Quorum of the Twelve. He addressed some of those issues and noted particularly the implications of what people in the popular press were saying about the church that weren't true.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the historians all got duped. Even some of them who were pointing out particular problems with the document. So I remember one and talking with one of them personally. And I won't mention who it was, but this was after everything had come out, and he had pointed out half a dozen problems with one of the Hoffman forgeries. But when talking with him after, it had never occurred to him this would be a forged document. And so it's what threshold makes you suspicious of a forgery? There are lots of forgeries out there, probably nowhere near as many as there are genuine documents, but, you know, what level of anomalies gets you to the point where you say, maybe this isn't genuine? And so that's... we can say at least that in the Joseph Smith Papers, one of the volumes in the last, I think it's Documents 9, there's a letter that is attributed to Joseph Smith that's often quoted in church publications, and they said, well, we don't have an original of this letter, and it was originally published by a critic, and it may be a forgery. And mm-hmm. So they're at least more aware of of those sorts of issues than they would have been in, 30 years earlier.
In the documentary, Richard Turley talks about what Hoffman's ultimate plan may well have been. I mean, he never said, but it makes sense to me. He had forged every exemplar of Martin Harris's handwriting.
Except one.
And which is what he based his stuff on. He had a great talent for mimicking handwriting. He had developed ink that was consistent with the time period. Although, when he heated it to bleed it through, it apparently would develop microscopic cracks. And that's how they were able to solve the...
I've talked with Kurt Throckmorton, and he said that it's
And Throckmorton is the expert who eventually discovered and could identify all of these forgeries scientifically and in court.
Right.
And that was one of the important things to breaking the case.
It was. But one of the things that he pointed out to me is that it's only at a certain... The ink developed in the aging process. The ink developed what Throckmorton called alligator ink.
Yeah.
So it develops cracks that look like an alligator's back. But those only appear at certain magnifications, that if you go down too far, you can't see them. You don't go down far enough, you can't see them. So it was really tricky, and I think there were two things that happened. In the end, Hoffman got a plea deal, and part of it was that so many new tests were developed by Throckmorton that they weren't sure whether these would hold up in court. And the other one is that, unfortunately, the prosecuting attorney, just as they were about to go to trial, was hit with allegations of impropriety himself.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And had to resign. And so the one person in the prosecutor's office who knew all the details enough to take it to court...
Wasn't there.
Had taken out. So they had to do a plea deal instead of going for what they had... the full conviction that they were hoping for. But that's... But
I do remember one thing. Yeah. He's still in prison.
Yes.
Hoffman still is. I remember one thing that President Hinckley said after all of this, because it has stuck with me. When they're talking about, well, how come that they were fooled? Well, how long did it happen? The famous Abraham Lincoln quote: "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but not all of the people all of the time." So he did fool people for a while, but it all fell down. And when you read the books, you can see that it was bound to at some point.
Yeah, the documentary kind of shows that.
Yeah. But Hinckley said that it's better to be occasionally disappointed than to live in a constant attitude of suspicion.
And Elder Oak said the same thing.
And Turley in this specifically talks about that and how, it would affect doctrinally. He talked about it from the perspective of agency. And so, I thought it was reported on pretty well here. There's been some interesting fallout from this, though. There's been some stories that have come out recently, particularly with regard to Matt Christensen, the father of one of the victims, Steve, and his family, and their interaction with Hoffman's children. In ways that at the time were kept secret by the families. And that's since come out, and I know...
There's an article in the Deseret News
this week.
We'd point you to that about...
Yeah.
One of the other things about this is, one of the stories is President Hinckley was worried about some of the problems even before the bombs came up. And has recounted the story a number of times, so I think I'm safe in telling it, because I got it from a written source, that he once locked himself in his office and prayed about it, and the answer he got of what to do about this situation, the answer he got from the Lord was, "Don't worry about it, it's in my hands." And I think that sometimes that's the case, is that events will eventually overtake it, and that it's not necessarily given to us to know how that's going to play out.
Well, you know, one of the things that came out, and I think this was in one of the talks from President Hinckley that you had sent us getting ready for tonight's program, John, was we go through periods in the church when the church is under pretty severe attack from whatever circumstances. I think we've been going through one now for a while, where all of a sudden people are surprised by things on the internet that are designed to affect their faith and their testimonies in a certain way. Things that have been out there forever, if they just, you know, had an interest to look, but because it wasn't spoon-fed to them or for whatever reason. And there's a lot of that going on, and it continues. And yet somehow we weather the storm and we're able to keep going on. And, you know, obviously the Lord is aware of those things. So what are some of the lessons, really quick, in the last couple of minutes that we take from this? I mean, obviously you mentioned the issue of providence and looking at the providence. I mean, the Joseph Smith papers themselves, I think, are pretty free from this kind of thing. You know, if there are issues, and we've talked about them on the program before, there are issues of more interpretation as opposed to, you know, actual forgery or fraud.
I think one of the things that we constantly get shown is that sometimes the experts aren't right. And one of the things that that came out of the Hoffman thing at the time is there was one document examiner who had detected the Hitler diaries as forgeries and then was duped by Hoffman. And then,
well, the FBI was duped.
And because of that, he left the profession. But oftentimes, you know, the experts do the best that they can, but they're not always right. And they can get fooled as well. I think the Doctrine and Covenants scripture says you can't always tell the wicked from the righteous. And this is
that's the verse I've been thinking of myself. And I think of also just ourselves. Whenever I run across something I didn't expect, the first thing to do is to not, you know, run around like Chicken Little saying the sky is falling, but to ask yourself, what should I expect? And that's part of what Jesus says. First check the beam in your own eye, then you shall see clearly. Because a lot of times if I just ask myself that question, oh, what should I expect? And instead of being shocked, I say, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. I wonder where I can go to learn more. That is just as reasonable. Well, in fact, it's a far more reasonable response to coming across something that you find a little bit upsetting or disturbing or unusual to just say, oh, I didn't know that. Where can I go to, you know, instead of being like, well, I should be entitled. I should have had everything spoon-fed to me. And it's dropping that sense of entitlement and then the sense of outrage. For me, I've been able to cruise through all of this stuff. And it's just that difference on the first encounter with anything that I hadn't been told or spoon-fed. Just, oh, that's interesting.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people who wrote things at this time, and I distinctly remember some of them were greatly impacted by the forgeries, and some of them were not. Richard Bushman, for example, had been very careful about all that, and now this came out after he was at press, but even then, it didn't really affect what his conclusions were for the most part.
And his book, Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, and it's partly due to the breadth of his research that was a small matter and didn't affect it.
So I think we just need to continue to hope that our historians and others who write on these subjects, and, you know, John, you do, Kevin does, maybe someday I will, we don't know, but that we continue to be careful about how we approach those things, because, you know, I've got a statue in my library, Michelangelo's Moses. He's got horns on his head because of the way they interpreted the scriptures. His face was shining is interpreted as he has horns.
But it's a magnificent
story. Oh, isn't it? He got his own seatbelt on his way up from St. George, let me tell you that.
Well, the original is absolutely incredible how thin the marble is on the
arm.
Folds of cloth.
Oh.
And how deep those incisions are.
I was a block away near the Colosseum, and I didn't realize it was in a different St. Mark's Chapel, and it is my biggest regret for Rome. If I ever go back, I want to see that.
All right.
So, want to thank you guys for being with us for this first hour. Join us for the second hour. We'll have a Come Follow Me discussion with John and Kevin. This is Terry Hutchinson with John Gee and Kevin Christensen for Interpreter Foundation Radio. Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson with co-host John Gee and Kevin Christensen in for our second half of tonight's Interpreter Radio broadcast for our Come Follow Me segment. Just want to begin by thanking our new sponsor, LDSAgents.com. Now, the real estate market, as nearly everybody knows, and if you've tried to find a house or sold a house, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You're getting multiple offers almost the very day. It won't stay like that for very much longer, but you never know. However, people still have to move. They still have lives to live, and therefore, oftentimes, you need to get an agent to help you sell your house or to help you buy one. And LDSAgents.com is a network of over 3,000 friendly, top-quality Latter-day Saint real estate agents. Now, for over 20 years, LDSAgents.com has been serving home buyers and sellers throughout the United States and Canada. So if you're buying or selling a home and you want to reduce the stress of your move, get in touch with LDSAgents.com, and they'll find somebody who you can work with. Their agents are experienced professionals. They'll focus on what matters most to you. They'll help you find a home in a safe neighborhood with good schools, nearby wards or branches. And if you need information about youth sporting programs or schools for special needs children, they can help with that too. So work with a real estate agent who shares your values and one you can trust. Go to LDSAgents.com on the internet. For over 20 years, they've been serving thousands of clients just like you. So wherever you are, no matter where you're moving, whether you're buying or whether you're selling, give LDS agents a try. Just go to their easy-to-use website. It's packed with useful information, LDSAgents.com. I just want to thank them for being a sponsor of our program this evening and every week. We have rotating co-hosts, and our lesson tonight is on Doctrine and Covenants, sections 41 through 44. And Kevin, what struck you about this section?
Well, this is very early on in church history again. I mean, it's 41 is February 4th, 1831, so the church is less than a year old. And it is talking about having a rapid increase in numbers in Kirtland. And I've living in around Pittsburgh, where, you know, it's just 90 minutes or so to get up to Kirtland and to visit these locations, so it's very exciting. But the things that they're focusing on is that this is a serious business that they're involved in, and there's all throughout these sections there's talk about order and authority, and about keeping the commandments and being pure, about obeying the commandments in ways that are just. You would think it wouldn't need to be stated so bluntly and clearly, but yet people are people. And so, yeah, these things about being honest, about being chaste, about being honorable, about speaking the Spirit, about respecting authority, about being able to discern who does have authority and who doesn't, about meeting obligations and having stewardships, about dealing with how to deal with when people die and what that might mean, and what difference it makes whether if you die in need, says you shall not taste of death, for it shall be sweet, and if they do not, woe unto them, for their death shall be bitter. So there's this voice of warning and encouragement that comes all through this that it comes across as very concentrated. You know, it's not rambling at all. It's just direct to the point. Let's get on with it. It's shape up and let's get to work.
You know, one of the things that strikes me, and this is brought up in the materials, is that the section before, which was given February 4th, the revelation instructs the prophet and the elders to pray to receive God's law. So they were praying for this. They were seeking for it at this time. The church was less than a year old, and it was experiencing tremendous growth. I mean, one of the things that one of the missionaries, I was reading some of the other material, Revelations in Context, which is also part of the Gospel Library app, but they were talking about a missionary who joined the church, and within just, I want to say, 6 or 8 months, he'd left his business and went to preach the gospel, and 70 people joined the church as a result. I mean, the growth was exponential. So what do you think, John and Kevin, are the ways that the people were prepared to receive this law? I mean, we'll talk quite a bit tonight about Section 42, which is referred to as God's law. But the section before, they were prepared. They were praying to receive it. And what were some other things maybe that they could do or did to receive it? We've got a general conference coming up in a couple of weeks. And what are some things we can do just like they did? We'll start with John and go to Kevin.
Oh, I was hoping it'd be the other way around. So if you're asking something of the Lord, you have to be prepared to do what it is he asks of you. And you have to be prepared that he might be calling you to repentance and that it might require a change on your part. And so that sometimes happens with conference where things we weren't expecting crop up. I don't think 3 years ago that any of us were expecting major changes to priesthood quorums, which I thought was really interesting because I had been in one ward where this would have been a great blessing, and another ward where it is a very different situation. So it impacted it differently. But you have to be prepared to get the no for the answer. If you're asking, say, about, can I have the 116 pages?
Can we have a change to the word of wisdom? That was the rumor that was about a year ago. You know, one of the things that you bring up,
We're not
getting a lot of rumors for this conference. I mean, and we didn't really last time either. I think the COVID is affecting the conference rumor mill that usually has gone on.
Well, I've noticed in listening to conference rumors, I usually try not to. and the reason why is the time in times when I've been listening to what people are, the rumors that they're spreading or things they're hoping for from conferences, we're really bad guessers.
Yeah, I was ready to subscribe to one a year ago where the church was going to buy the Kirtland Temple, and that was going to be their big announcement, you know, for the bicentennial of the first vision, but nope.
No, we got a proclamation.
We got a proclamation instead. A lot cheaper.
and you know, we got COVID restrictions. Nobody was really...
We weren't expecting that either.
When President Nelson said, be prepared for a conference unlike any you've ever experienced before, well, we got it.
We got it, yeah.
And I think that many times the conference rumors probably say more about the people who are spreading them, and usually not in a good way, than they do about the
Ouch.
Church.
That's painful. That's painful for me.
It's just, you know, we like to guess, and
Thank you for saying at least.
I'm always guessing wrong, so I just don't put any stock in my guesses and very little in anyone else's, and I'm usually not disappointed that way.
So, Kevin, what can we add to preparing to receive the law, so to speak? Hello?
I'm not hearing anything.
Yeah.
Well,
I think I got muted. Yeah, I must have accidentally muted myself. Okay. Yeah, just to take seriously what we've received already.
At the other end.
Yeah. just the kind of counsel that's in here is like in 42, ye shall observe the laws which ye have received and be faithful, and ye shall hereafter receive church covenants, such as shall be sufficient to establish you both here and in the New Jerusalem. Therefore, he that lacketh wisdom, let him ask of me, and I will give him liberally, and upbraid him not. Just lift up your hearts and rejoice. So there's, you know, just, I think, focus on the positive things. And, you know, I participate on, like, the Mormon Dialogue and Discussion Board probably more than any other. But every once in a while, you know, around a conference, someone will start a conference thread and say, what do you think's coming? And I just can't bring myself to read them because I'm perfectly content to wait and see. That's what it's for. I mean, I'm more likely to be correct if I don't worry about it. And I don't, and the conferences have been uplifting and interesting, and we've been reminded with this COVID thing that it can be very important to pay attention and to be ready for what comes.
Yeah, I think, so I remember reading a couple of years ago someone's things about things they'd like to change about sacrament meeting. And, you know, they surveyed all these members of the church and
Were pajamas included in that by any chance?
No. It was interesting because, with one exception, which actually got implemented before the book came out, in between the writing and the publishing of the book, the members didn't like most of the proposed changes. By and large, they didn't see the need to have some of these changes that the people who put together the survey were pushing. But I think, you know, what we've learned in the last year is just how we've realized how important sacrament meeting is. We realized what's important about it.
Yeah.
The sacrament's the most important, and then the other things that we may have taken, some of us may have taken for granted, are we realize what's important about them. What difference does it make whether you sing the hymn? You know,
for example, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, for example. And what
when I'm in St. George, and I mean, all through this, we've been able to sing. Whereas up in, you know, say if I go to church with my folks in Alpine or with Janae and Alpine or whatever, I mean, for a period of time, you were allowed to listen as they played it, and that's a different experience.
Yeah, and but things like, you know, what you hearing talks in church is so regular, and then not during talks in church.
Well, you know, my dad, as you know, was pretty sick during most of the last year, and so he was home. So we did a lot of home church and took the sacrament to my folks. And oftentimes some of the grandchildren would be around in various degrees or whatever, and sometimes it was just us. And it was a real special experience. And he would mention every week how much he appreciated that and being able to do that. And it showed, for me anyway, that what was really important about that, and the, you know, the Come Follow Me program, which puts everything in the home, and then bam, all of a sudden everything really is in the home. The timing of that was miraculous, if you will.
Impeccable. It's those sorts of things that let us appreciate what it is that's that's important, and we haven't had the church was able to roll with the punches. I think about, and it's not that certain things haven't, if you listen to Elder Bednar in the Religious Freedom Forum, he was very concerned about some of the government clampdown on exercise of religion, but it actually didn't affect the church that much. So it was other religious organizations who were suing the government for First Amendment violations. The church didn't have to.
Mm-hmm. Well,
not that they didn't side with
no,
the religious expression of religious freedom, but the programs are already in place so that they didn't really they could work with.
Well, with the structure that we have and the emphasis on the sacrament and the family and the lay priesthood, we're able to worship in our homes. We don't require to go to a building. The socialization aspect of that, I think, we'll feel and we'll notice once things open up more. I suspect we're going to see a big drop in some of our attendance because of that. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's a sociological question, I guess.
Well, the thing is that the church is, it's been nice to get the heads up about the religious freedom issues when we're not impacted.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that we need to preserve our religious liberty. I've been to at academic conferences where where scholars of religion have argued that that religious freedom needs to be curtailed worldwide, and that it needs to be stamped out. And so we know that this is being plotted already, but it's nice to see some of the impact ahead of time. And
so in February of 1831, Joseph Smith wrote Martin Harris, and he said, "We have received the laws of the kingdom since we came, and the principles in these parts the disciples in these parts, if you will, have received them gladly." So we go to section 42, which is the law of the Lord. And I understand historically that the last maybe six or seven verses came as a result of a later conference and then were later added into 42. But the basic principles are there. So, Kevin and John, let's each of us take for a minute the portions of this law, if you will, this part of God's law that stand out to you the most. And we'll start with Kevin this time because we've got John last.
This is in 42, right?
Yeah, this is in 42,
And then verse 11, one thing that I like here is he says, "And it shall not be given unto anyone to go forth to preach my gospel or to build up my church, except he is ordained by someone who has authority, and it is known to the church that he has authority, and has been regularly ordained by the heads of the church." It struck me reading this time that I remember one of the earliest Christian documents is called the Didache. It's one of the earliest acts of the New Testament, and it's about deciding who really is an apostle, who is really authorized, and it gives some criteria for that. And it just struck me that this is a live issue very early on, and that it's important to know about authority. And it's one of the distinctive things, you know, that I've noticed growing up in the church is concern about authority, that it's mentioned over and over in the founding stories and in the scriptures, and to see it here emphasized, you know, the orderliness and the insistence on a clear line of authority to be able to do things. You know, it just strikes me as very consistent with the earliest Christian church and very important, because we've seen what can go wrong. You know, my wife was in France, you know, in the aftermath of some things that went wrong with a group of people in the church in France while back where somebody just decided they had their own authority. And I've seen this, you know, show up on occasion in various places, but you know, this idea that the line of authority is important.
Okay, John?
One of the things that struck me, I'll just mention when glancing, because we're talking about Hugh Nibley, his interpretation of Doctrine and Covenants 42. And so I'll read it the way he would do it. Thou shalt not be idle, for he that is idle, which he put as the rich, shall not eat the bread nor wear the garments of the laborer, the poor. But to me, what struck me is this one, this is in verse 45. We quote this a lot, and we think we generally take it to heart in the church. Thou shalt live together in love, insomuch as thou shalt weep for the loss of them that die, and more especially for those that have not hope of a glorious resurrection. But this command to weep for mourn for those who go to the other side of the veil, and in contrast to some recent events, and where you have reports of people's death that are greeted with jubilation and an outpouring of vitriol about people who are so glad that they're dead, which is the very opposite of what's being admonished here in the Doctrine and Covenants, is that this should be a cause for mourning, especially if we don't think they've been good people. And that's a higher law that's sometimes hard to live up to.
It seems as though in our day it's getting worse.
Yes.
Instead of better. Would you say that's the case, Kevin?
Yeah. Yeah, I've noticed that too. That there's a certain amount of polarization. And quite frankly, there's times when I'm guilty of that myself. This is a good reminder for me.
Yeah. Well, and that's close to the one that got me. And, of course, I've had a personal experience with this recently, and it shall come to pass, verse 46, that those that die in me shall not taste of death, for it shall be sweet unto them. And they that die not in me, woe unto them, for their death is bitter. So we had that experience with my dad. You know, he lived a good life, and it really was not... It wasn't what I expected, and you know, because he was ready and he was comfortable and confident in a humble way. I mean, obviously, you know, when you get to that stage, you're still jumping into the unknown to a certain degree. There's no, you know, there's no guarantees, if you will. At least in your mind, you always think, hey, I probably could have done better. Well, and if he wasn't good enough, I think a lot of us are going to have troubles, you know. So, anyway, that's one of the things that struck me, and it's interesting that that's given as part of the law, along with these other things. Don't kill, don't lie. But if you do lie, or if you do this, or if you fall down morally, you can repent, and here's how you do it. And then... if you offend somebody, you can go to them and work it out. And then if you can't work it out, then you go to the next level. It's more of a community type of thing. And it reminds me of a talk that Elder Christofferson gave to the church education system about Truth Endures. And he specifically talked, it was either that one or it was his talk in conference a few years ago on A Day of Warning, where he talked about the shame culture and the guilt culture.
It was the conference talk.
Okay, the general conference talk. John knows what I'm talking about. Kevin, you probably do too.
I quote it in my book.
Well, there we go. So where you talk about the difference between the shame culture and the guilt culture. In the guilt culture, you feel personally responsible for your actions, and then you take an effort to repent or to change on your own internally, if you will. But the shame culture, or is it the other way around?
Yeah, no, the guilt culture, you are motivated because you feel guilty and bad about what you've done.
Yes.
Internally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Everyone else makes you feel bad. Because
on, and we see more external. And more of that, and that's getting worse than ever, I think, about all kinds of different things.
And
it comes from both sides.
Yeah, it does. Elder Christofferson was quoting David Brooks. He said, you know, in a guilt culture, you can at least hate the sin and love the sinner.
Yeah.
But in a shame culture, you can't.
No. You have to hate the sinner.
Have to hate the sinner. And a lot of people, not in the church, have pointed out the parallels to the novel 1984, where you've got the, is it the 2-minute hate or the 5-minute?
George Orwell, I read it in high school, and I've never gone back. Yeah.
It's where you know, as a daily routine, you talk about how much, or you think about how much you hate this particular ideological group, whichever one that happens to have been designated yesterday, and that drives your day. And we've gotten to that point where too often we can't appreciate, say, someone on the other side's good qualities. Because we're just so consumed about what we perceive as their bad qualities. And I'll refer back to what Kevin pointed out some time ago, which is the parable of the about the mote versus the beam in your eye,
mm-hmm.
is that too often all we're seeing is that beam. We're not, and we're attacking other people's motes because of the beam in our own eye, and we don't recognize it.
Yeah, Kevin, what's another thing that stands out to you from this section?
Well, again, this is talking about there's these promises that they're, you know, about weeping for those that lost. It goes on to talk about faith. And it come to pass that he that hath faith to be healed and is not appointed unto death shall be healed. He that hath faith to see shall see. He that hath faith to hear shall hear. And the lame that hath faith to leap shall leap. And they who have not faith to do these things but believe in me have power to become my sons, inasmuch as they break not my laws and shall bear their infirmities. So there's, I'm thinking about these different responses. Sometimes that compares with elsewhere in the Doctrine and Covenants in the Scriptures about different spiritual gifts. And sometimes, you know, the faith to be healed or to heal are different spiritual gifts. And there are other gifts. And he says no one has all the gifts. So sometimes a person may not have faith to be healed, but has other kinds of faith and can do other things. You know, one of the spiritual gifts is the gift of administration, which I think is striking and interesting. that's one I do not have. You know,
it's interesting when you look at the lives of the prophets in the latter days. I think you can tell which ones had the gift of administration and which ones didn't, in certain respects. I mean, each of them has their strengths. For example, I grew up as a very young man. President Kimball became the prophet when I was about 13, and he led the church for 12 years. And, you know, the growth of the church at that time was staggering. The number of missionaries doubled, and, you know, afterwards we needed somebody to come in and just kind of help us regroup, if you will, and strengthen that growth. And that's when we got President Benson with the Book of Mormon and the emphasis on, you know, cleansing the inner vessel and all those other things that he taught. The administrative differences between Brigham Young and Joseph Smith were incredible. And Brigham, he, to his credit, never criticized the prophet, but he had to be looking at some of the things Joseph did and biting his lip or tongue, because he obviously could administrate and organize in circles around Joseph at times. And Joseph's gifts were in much different areas. I think, Kevin, that's a really good point. In fact, I was going to take that one and run with it, and so I'm glad you did. Go ahead, John.
Well, along those, in those same verses, I think, you know, it's talking about he who has faith to see shall see. I've seen that happen. But, you know, a lot of times we, and it's pointed out in the Doctrine and Covenants that, that sometimes you get the afflictions and you still don't get the healing, even if you've got faith. But a lot of us probably feel like we don't have that sort of faith. And then so you get verse 52. And they who have not faith to do these things, but believe in me,
mm-hmm.
have power to become my sons. So the main requirement is to believe in Jesus Christ.
Yeah, you don't beat yourself up because you don't have the faith to get this miracle.
Right, and that's the more important thing is that you have the faith in Christ than you have necessarily the miracles. And that's that should give us encouragement, or if we think that we may, our faith not may not be sufficient, is that it can be sufficient and it can grow into where it needs to be if we place it right. If we put our faith in the right, in Jesus Christ, rather than on something else.
So, as I'm reading this, there's an element, if you will, about the consecration. You mentioned in the last hour, John, about people wanting to know more about Hugh Nibley, read Approaching Zion. And it reminds me of a cartoon I saw. This guy's overlooking this great estate with a big fountain and everything else, and his wife is obviously talking to another woman behind, and he's just sitting there staring into space, and she just says, he's been this way ever since he read Approaching Zion. You know, what should he be doing? But this was something that they were attempting even at this very early stage. It's another evidence of how much was really going on here. I mean, Kevin mentioned at the beginning of our segment here, this was early days. But here we are, the church is growing like crazy, and yet all of a sudden they're undertaking this effort to have all things in common and to live a law of consecration. Different than, you know, some of the brethren have made great distinguishments between some this and some of the other, if you would call it a communitarian experience or experiment.
Yeah.
And people were putting their property in and taking it out. And it's just another thing that here it is right in the law of the Lord. And at this stage, we don't have the full temple endowment like we do now. But now when we go through the temple, there is, you know, an element of a covenant involved with this.
Well, and so much of this comes so early, as you pointed out. You think that over half of the Doctrine and Covenants is given within the first 3 years of the church, 3 to 4 mm-hmm. years of the church. And it's, you know, for the next 9 years, it's not that Joseph Smith stops receiving revelation, but the machinery is already in place to run the church. We haven't, we have canonized only 2 sections of the Doctrine and Covenants in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And and one official declaration.
Kevin, I think, covers that third one, 136, right, Kevin?
Brigham Young? Yeah, Brigham Young, yeah.
But there's, mm-hmm. it's the problem we have is living up to the law that we've got. And it's not that the Lord doesn't want to give us more, but sometimes these are, there are adjustments in the programs, not major changes in the revelations. And so the bigger thing is to pay attention to what the Lord has given us and to try to conform our lives to it. And for most of that, that's almost more than we can handle.
Yeah, and once again, the section covers this, but it covers it in terms of an administration, in terms of how they handle those things, as opposed to, you're going to do this. It's like, okay, we're doing this, but this is the way you do it. So it's a different type of a thing, like you said, and it really sets us up the structure, if you will, of how we do everything else. So we go after that one, we go to the next section where, we talk about this this priority of revelation, if you will. Kevin, tell us a little bit about that from section 43.
From section 43, okay. Again, this is still in Ohio in Kirtland. And let's see, it's just talking about... For verily, verily, I say unto you that ye have received a commandment for a law unto my church, through him whom I have appointed unto you to receive commandments and revelations from my hand. And this ye shall know as assuredly, that there is none other appointed unto you to receive revelations and commandments and revelations until he is taken, if he abide in me. And verily, verily, I say unto you that none else shall be appointed unto this gift except it be through him. For if it be taken from him, he shall not have power except to appoint another in his stead. And this shall be a law unto you, that ye receive not the teachings of any that come before you as revelations or commandments. And I give unto you this, that ye may not be deceived, that ye may know that they are not of me. And so it's setting this order, the importance of the hierarchy in an order where things are orderly and not just... anyone can come in and declare that their ideas are divine and they should be listened to. It's in a way to just point us in the right direction and to have a structure that works. And within the church, like today in Sunday school, we were talking about the law of common consent. And that's an important part of our culture. And also an important part of it is this respective hierarchy. And Taylor Gibbons wrote a really good book about LDS culture, and this is one of the things that he called it People of Paradox. And this is one of the things that he liked, is that it has that these both aspects are important in church culture, both the respect for authority and the respect for agency. That comes together, and it should be in a creative tension. That you don't try and resolve it completely one way or the other, but you keep both there. That as Lehi says, the opposition is always in all things. And it's just the way that, throughout all of creation, if you look for that, that's that creative tension. That's what allows there to be life on this planet, for us to be going through this and look at these questions. And within our own bodies, the same thing happens with the endocrine system, where there's always this balance going on. So this is important to keep this... a sense of authority and to know how the revelation is coming through Joseph, but also to seek it for ourselves. And, we seek it for ourselves, not for the whole church, to say, I disagree with something Joseph Smith said, therefore I'm going to go find out what the real truth is, and then I'll spread that. It's ruling that out completely, but I can find out for myself that what he's saying is true, and I can find out for my individual circumstances something that is important. And, I've been around for 67 years now, and we've been talking for the past, several of our shows together, how inspired and insightful we feel with President Nelson's changes that were so effective in preparing us for this whole global pandemic. And yet I've also seen inspiration from a range of other leaders at different levels in the church that have been directly, you know, important for you know, my mission president had things that helped us as missionaries, and various bishops had things, and my mom and dad, and my wife and I, when we've decided, shall we take this job? Shall we make this move? What shall we do here? You know, they had revelations that had directly to do with important issues for repentance that have been very important. But it's always orderly. And that's established in very clear terms, you know, very effectively from the start right here.
You know, that kind of reminds me, we really receive revelation, Kevin, for our stewardships. And that kind of goes to the heart of what they were talking about in the last section. And it's not just the stewardship over the lands, if you will. It's the stewardship over our families and our lands and everything else about us, our sphere, if you will, as it describes in section 93. We're responsible for, you know, our stewardship over our families. When my children marry and move away, my responsibility to them changes. It doesn't mean I stop being their father and we stop being their parents, but it does mean that they have stewardship over what they're doing with their lives. What jobs do they take? Where do they live? How do they raise their children? All of those things. I may have my opinions about them, but if I'm smart, I will keep them to myself. You know? And I think that's true. But I've had bishops, as have you, where he's received revelation for our ward and for us in particular circumstances that's been extremely valuable and helpful. And, you know, I can't receive revelation that goes outside that stewardship responsibility, so to speak. And so I do think that there's a lot to be said for that. And that kind of gets us into something else that's mentioned here, and that is the issue of quorums and relief society groups. So there's a section where we're asked to explain why God organizes us into priesthood quorums and relief societies. What do you think? We'll start with you, John, this time.
Well, I think part of it has to do with levels of organization. So if you hark back to the Exodus, one of the pieces of advice that Moses gets from his father-in-law, Jethro, is to not have Moses answering all the questions and for everybody, but to break it down so that there are groups of 10 and 20 and 100. We have that in the church. You have the general organization, you have areas, you have stakes, you have wards, and then you have the quorums inside the ward. And it puts it down at a manageable and local level so that, for example, I know of one ward that has a large number of people in who are gluten intolerant. And for people with celiac disease, this is a terrible thing. And it makes it easy to adapt to that situation on the ward level where the sacrament bread is just gluten-free, where the next ward over doesn't have that problem, no need to do that. And you can adapt it for the individual circumstances easier on the smaller level. And you can meet people's individual needs easier on the smaller level. So we each have our own spheres of influence where we can help people, and it doesn't make sense for necessarily for complete strangers to have to help everyone's need when they don't know them. And this allows, so quorums and Relief Society groups on the smaller unit allows things to adapt and fit the individual's need perhaps a little better than on the larger level. When it becomes necessary, then they can organize and have large-scale influence, such as if there is a catastrophe someplace. Then we can organize and have lots of us go help where it's needed. But on the local level, usually it's more likely you'll get that that help from somebody that you know and are close to.
And it's more individualized. So, Kevin, Julie Bangeter Beck gave a talk about this at BYU. And one of the things that she said, it was to organize us under the priesthood and after the pattern of the priesthood. What is the pattern of the priesthood in this instance?
Well, I guess it's the organization of the church. They're kind of looking at the article of faith about we believe in the same organization that existed in the primitive church. And so you have apostles, and apostles are the general authorities. And then they have the 70s, and they're more regional, and the bishops are local authorities. And that's a pattern of organization. And I worked in most of my technical writing for my career has been in computer-aided engineering. And I'm a technical writer myself, but within the corporation, within the software, there's this notion that hierarchy is a strategy for dealing with complexity. And a lot of times in societies or corporations, people think of hierarchy as power. You know, you go up in the hierarchy to get more power, and the have-nots don't have it, and they're oppressed by the people with it. Like the hierarchies are enemies, and somehow it's some kind of social toxin or something to be exploited. But with this, but from the point of view of engineering, it's simply a strategy for dealing with complexity. You know, and there's problems that are best dealt with at a high level by general authorities, and there are problems that are best dealt with at a local level, you know, by people closer to implementation. And it's just a way of handling those situations, and, you know, dividing into quorums. My wife has been a Relief Society president on a couple of times, and I've seen how she works with other authorities and how she delegates authority and how she's done good and helped, you know, all sorts of people in that calling. I've had different callings ranging from, you know, working in the nursery to being an elders quorum instructor or a missionary. It's just different times. I've been placed in different slots to do different things, and hopefully sometimes it's been a pretty good fit with my talents, and other times it's been more of a struggle. But even those, one of the lessons that I take away is it helps me appreciate the people that have those talents.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate being in this community where there are all of these different talents that are all serving within the same hierarchy to accomplish good for each other. I think it's a beautiful thing.
Well, it's like the gift of administration.
Yeah.
You were referred to earlier. Some people have it. Some people don't. You know, it's really interesting that these principles that we're talking about is really commanded by the Lord in section 44. and he just says that, and many shall be converted, insomuch that ye shall obtain power to organize yourselves according to the laws of man, that your enemies may not have power over you, that you may be preserved in all things, that you may be enabled to keep my laws, that every bond may be broken wherewith the enemy seeketh to destroy my people. Behold, I say unto you, that ye must visit the poor and the needy and administer to their relief, that they may be kept until all things may be done according to my law which ye have received. Amen. Really, isn't that what James says is true religion? I think it's James, isn't it?
Yeah. End of chapter 1.
Yeah.
your religion is this.
That, you know, that really is the law of the Lord. These other things are important to do. But notice a lot of them are more negatives. Thou shalt not do this. Thou shalt not do this. But this is certainly an affirmative, and it goes right hand in hand with what, you know, John, you and Kevin and we were just talking about in terms of the pattern of the priesthood and why we have quorums, why we have religious societies, is to be able to help each other as an individual. You were mentioning, John, earlier about the importance of sacrament meeting and how we've learned how important that is during the pandemic. Something that struck me today is when I'm in a meeting, even if it's a Zoom meeting, if I know the people and they're talking about some of their trials or challenges or they're admonishing me in a certain thing, when I know their background and I know more about them, it hits home. I really can relate to it more than just showing up at a random Zoom meeting where I don't know who the speakers are, I don't know much about them or anything else. And so, you know, being able to attend on a regular basis and associate with our ward members through our quorums and our relief societies, it helps us be able to know them, if you will. Mm. And then we're edified when they share with us. I mean, in another way, we can help them bear their burdens when, you know, there's some kind of a sickness or they need some support in some fashion. But then also, there's the ability for us to be edified, like I said, when I know them and I know more about them and their challenges and their struggles and how they got where they are. Then when they say, well, and I feel this about that, that really has an impact for me that is much greater than just, like I said, just some person telling me a scripture or something like that. It really resonates with me inside. Do you feel that way?
Yes, definitely. It's when we hear each other's stories and grow empathy and understanding, then we start to see each other. We see ourselves in each other, and then it's this idea that the law starts with sacrifice. That's just saying it's not all about me, and I acknowledge that. I'm willing to sacrifice. I'm going to give up something that I may want for myself because I can see that it's not all about me. It's about you and it's about God. And then I want to be, it's when Enos talks about having his soul expanded. That's what's happening. His soul gets larger than himself when he brings others within that. And he sees himself and his others. He's worried about his family. And if it gets even larger, then he's concerned about his enemies too. And that's what this expansion of love is about, that we help one another and bear one another's burdens that they be light. And we mourn with those that mourn. We comfort those that stand in need of comfort. I think that's the invitation into this community. And it struck me just like in the last one, there's a passage in verse 43 where he's, there's one of these where he says, if you take somebody's, you know, you don't take anybody's clothes, and if they give you something, pay for it. It struck me, it's like King Benjamin's discourse after all, you know, all of this magnificent discourse, and they've been told that they're forgiven of their sins. And then he goes, you know, right to saying, and if you borrow something, give it back. You know, something that's just basic and practical and kind and thoughtful. That it's not just all abstractions and putting on a show on Sunday. It's the practical day-to-day interactions to take care and thought for one another that are part of the gospel. And if we treat them that way and take them with that importance, then we can live that kind of experience that helps us see why it's meaningful.
I don't have much to add.
Here we go. Kevin's given us the keys. Well, that's, you know, this is such a great mix, though, of practical application of the law. And that's why probably the saints were rejoicing. You know, I really like the materials that are given to us that parallel just the reading of the scriptures. This one, I mean, the context is really good in this Revelations in Context Stephen Harper did the article on this, and he specifically says, the church's need for the revelations at this time was acute. When he arrived in Ohio, Joseph found the saints there to be sincere but confused about biblical teachings, that early Christians were of one heart and of one soul. Many of the church's converts in Ohio were members of the family, a communal group that shared the home and farm of Lucy and Isaac Morley in an effort to be true Christians. So they had all that to go on. And so there's a lot more to this in the background than just, some of these. And these are important because they do have application in modern times. But to see how they applied it to their circumstances helps us translate that and give it to ourselves to do that. So
exactly.
this is a great segment for us, and it's more performance oriented than a lot of what we do in the Come Follow Me. The Doctrine and Covenants is just full of a lot of practical advice, and this one here, though, they were praying for the law, they prepared to receive it. They did receive it, and then, ultimately they were admonished by the Lord to go and do it, which I think most of them did. And hand in hand with that, they were also given that injunction to take care of the poor in particular and those who were needy. I think that you can't just look at some of these sections, if you will, or revelations in isolation. They yeah. tend to come in groups.
And I think what you mentioned about the poor is Ambrose Bierce said about this group of people is that they moved on when they finally got wealthy enough to reach the state of indigenous. Or indigenous. So they were really poor back then.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. We'll join next week for another round of Interpreter Foundation Radio. But I want to thank you on behalf of my co-hosts, John Gee and Kevin Christensen. And join us again next week for more of Interpreter Foundation Radio. This is Terry Hutchinson. Thank you for listening.